Our share tonight has two goals. The first goal is to get us thinking about the core ideas for the week. When is someone's gaze invading your space a problem? Whose problem is it? What, if anything, must one do to rectify that problem? And who must do the rectifying? So that's, hopefully we're gonna come out tonight with these questions even more alive in our head than they are right now. That's one of our goals. The other goal, and it is an overlapping goal, is to introduce the early rabbinic sources, the Tannaitic sources, mostly from the Mishnah, which are going to become the basis of our learning for the rest of the week. So especially tomorrow morning, we're going to begin with a very difficult sugya, and it is a difficult sugya that incorporates a lot of Tannaitic early rabbinic sources. I shouldn't have translated that, but that was my bad. A lot of Tannaitic sources, and I want you to leave tonight having a basic sense of those Tannaitic sources so we can jump right into the Gemara learning tomorrow morning. So those are our two goals, to get our sort of juices going in terms of thinking about the ideas, to get introduced to the Tannaitic sources, and haba hatalia. These things will help each other out. Learning those Tannaitic sources will get the juices going. Getting those juices going will help us learn these Tannaitic sources with a more attuned eye. So let me begin by saying the sugyas that we're going to be learning this week are going to be focused almost exclusively, not almost, they're going to be focused exclusively on questions of physical space and privacy. That is to say, how do I ensure that my home, my courtyard, my roof are places where I can do what I want to do? And what happens when your architecture sort of invades my privacy? That's what the sugyas will be talking about. And there will be many things that come up in our lives that are directly relevant, that are easily extrapolatable from the sources we'll be learning. And there'll be other things that aren't. So I want to start by asking, aside from questions of physical privacy, which is still very much relevant, my family, we moved into an apartment 3 years ago, and when we moved into our current apartment, there were blinds on the windows in all the rooms except for the living room, and we never got around 3.5 years later to putting blinds on the living room windows, and so I'm still very acutely aware that when I'm in my living room, I don't have privacy, right? When we were lighting our Hanukkah candles, I mean, that's a good time not to have blinds on your window, but, you know, when I'm standing up in my living room, folks on the street can see me. And I'm aware of that, right? So these questions of physical buildings and privacy are still very much alive. But I want to start by asking you, what are other places in our lives where questions of privacy, my space, your gaze, might come into contact with each other? And, let's just start by brainstorming. So I'm going to take one from Leah Gittel. I'm going to take two from Tamir. And three from Josephine. We'll take another round in a moment. Yeah, Leah Gittel.
I just think auditory privacy, in my house, in the summer, we open the windows and everyone, our boss also does that, you can hear everything that everyone says in the house next door, and the apartment next door, and the other side, you can really hear everyone's conversation.
Great. So Leah Gittel raises the question of hearing, right? We're talking about hezekiah, about damage caused by sight. There actually are questions. I didn't bring them in the packets, but there are some 19th and 20th century sources that talk about, well, what about overhearing things, right? Does that fall in some overlapping category with hezekiah? And so certainly, you know, what are those spaces where, and the truth is maybe in at least 21st century America, if you don't live in an apartment building, this might be less relevant than it would have been in the past, but maybe not. And so certainly sort of that overlapping sound. Excellent. Tamir.
I was thinking of being on the subway and like looking over someone's shoulder at what they're, a book they're reading or a text they're sending.
Yes. Yeah.
Recently I saw someone open a funny Facebook group.
Bedidi Hava Uvda. It literally happened to me tonight on my way to the yeshiva. It was a bit of a cramped train, and I didn't even notice I was doing it. I was looking at the person next to me and their texts, right? I didn't mean to do it, right? But they were right there. They were on their, holding their phone like that. And so is that moment on the subway when you notice someone's texts or, you know, what they're reading, whatever else, is that an invasion of privacy? What kind of privacy might they be expected to expect? Josephine was third, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say a variation on the same thing. Like, if you're sitting next to someone's class and you're looking at their laptop screen, and, like, why is that different from if you're looking at their notebook and they're sitting next to you, and maybe there are differences between the digital and the physical, if they're, like, taking notes and you missed a word and you want to see if they wrote it down, versus, like, if they're not taking notes on their laptop.
Great. So Josephine says, the difference, you know, when you're seeing someone's laptop next to you in class and seeing their notes, and the question of, is that different from their notebook? Josephine, let me put you on the spot. Say one sentence about why it is or isn't different. It sounds like you're feeling there might be a difference between the laptop and the notebook. Say out what you think it might be.
Yes, it's different. Like, there's definitely privacy in both senses that you can be invading by looking at what they're writing or doing. But I think that there's there's a greater chance they wouldn't want you to see what they're doing if they're on their computer versus if they're keyboard.
Okay, so maybe that both are entitled as much privacy as Josephine, but it's harder to avoid noticing their screen than it is. It's pretty easy to avoid looking at their notebook. Did I get you right? Not quite.
That's one, and two is that if they're taking notes in class in their notebook, there's a good chance they don't care if you look at what they're writing.
Oh.
They care more if they're checking their email. Or
got it.
Got it. So it's easier to avoid looking at the notebook, but they might care less. They might care more about. So they might care less about the notebook also. Got it. Great. Okay. So without further ado, let's actually jump in to some learning of texts. We are going to start with source number one, as you would expect, in this packet. This is not a text that's actually going to come up in our sugyas. This is a text that does not, to my mind, weirdly come up in the context of Hezekiah. I've yet to see an authority early or late who raises the story of David and Melech and Bathsheba in the context of Hezekiah, but you will see why it feels like an extremely relevant story. Can I get a volunteer, one volunteer to read the Hebrew and one volunteer to read the English? Actually, maybe the English first, please. Volunteer to read the English? Tekoa, thank you. And then one volunteer to read the Hebrew? You'll be great.
Late one afternoon, David rose from his couch and strolled on the roof of the royal palace, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful, and the king sent someone to make inquiries about the woman. He reported she is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, and wife of Uriah the Hittite. David sent messengers to fetch her. She came to him, and he lay with her. She had just purified herself after her period, and she went back.
I will say, even though I want us to work in whatever language makes sense for you tonight, I just want to name that she just purified herself after a period is like a classic hornet's nest among scholars and translators. It's hard to know exactly what that phrase means. But, Naomi, if you could read the Hebrew for us. Okay, so whatever language it makes sense for you to be looking at right now, I'm going to ask three questions about this text, and I want us to answer them in order. And I'm telling you that now because our answers are going to overlap, but I want to try to keep these questions separate. So the first thing I want to do is, what do you notice about this text? If this is a text that you have heard before or learned before or just heard the story and not seen the text inside before, what surprises you here? If this is a text that you're learning for the first time, what catches your eye? So the first question is, what do you notice? Without any judgments, without any attempt to make meaning of it, just what do you notice here? What catches your attention? What surprises you? Question number one. Then we will ask, what are the problems here? Right? What is going on here that is problematic? The Tanakh itself, this story, when it continues, it's clear that the Tanakh does not think this is a good story. Hashem does not think this is a good story. Bad things happen as a result of this. But I want us to name, what are the problems going on here? And then the third question I'm going to ask is, what are the protocols you might put in place to prevent something like this happening? So first, what do you notice? Then when we've gone through that well, we're going to talk about what are the problems here, and then what protocols might you put in place to deal with the problems. So what do you notice? I got Nissim with one. Can I get one or two more? I've got Jord with two, and I've got Mima with three.
To go back to the issue that you mentioned with the translation, he conditioned between the top. She was separated, or purified, separated from her impurity. It's kind of strange that we're mentioning this. Like, David is clearly sleeping with a married woman, and what the text is focused on is the fact that she was perhaps a non-nida, or whatever this concept of tuma is, but that's kind of... It just surprises me that the text jumps on that when clearly there are bigger issues at play here.
Beautiful. So there's something strange about the mention of this purifying from impurity. What that actually is, like I said, scholars hotly debate this, and we're not going to go into it because it's not going to be so relevant to the focus of our concern. But Nisman's absolutely right to notice, like, there's something weird here, and like, why is the text telling us that, right? Like, what is the Torah trying to get across by mentioning this point? Beautiful. Jord.
I think my thought is I'm trying to figure out what the practicalities of this situation are, and that, like, where David is located physically in relationship to Bathsheba, and how his couch is in such proximity to that place that
okay.
This is that, but then also, this is my, like, second thought is the literal, like the sight lines in relation to the sun and visibility, given that it is late in the afternoon.
Okay.
How is he making conclusions under dim lighting?
Great. So I want to linger on what George is raising. George is raising both a spatial question and a temporal question, right? What's the geography? What's the topography here? And what's going on in terms of the sunlight? What time? And I'll just say, just to start, the Hebrew, this is the JPS translation. The Hebrew here, Vayhi le'es ha'erev, it was at the time of evening. That's sort of similar to the language we get by Yitzhak when he goes out to... Well, Davin Mincha is what the rabbis understand it, but to meet Rivka. So it's like late afternoon, early evening, like it's when it's starting to get dark, right? That much we can say with some confidence. Let's think about what does it seem like is the topography of the situation here, either from things that you can notice in the text or that you would speculate about based on, well, I can imagine things being that way. Yeah, Dean, give me one insight into the topography.
I was looking at the first pasuk. It says, "So David is telling us Hagag beTamalah, and then he sees a woman rochetes me'al Hagag." So I was wondering what the word me'al Hagag means there, because it could either refer to him being like, "I like David is on the roof and he sees Bathsheba washing herself like somewhere, like maybe not on the roof, maybe in her house or whatever, or it could be she's washing on the roof."
He saw her bathing on the roof. Yeah, that song screws it up for us, because almost, as far as I know, all scholars, and as far as I saw all traditional Jewish parshanim as well, read this as, he's on the roof. We don't necessarily know where she is. It's not just Leonard Cohen, by the way, of blessed memory, right? It's also, like, the whole history of painting Bathsheba on the roof. It's super interesting to talk about. I would love to talk more about why there's that history of her being on the roof over a meal at some point. It actually is relevant. Well, all right, let's linger here. So he's on the roof. Right, he gets up from his bed at Le'es Erev, right, like evening time, late afternoon, early evening, something like that, and he sees her bathing from his roof. We don't know where she is, right? But what might we speculate if he's seeing her from his roof? Where might we speculate that she is bathing? Yeah, Le'Gittel.
Yeah, I was thinking that if it mentions that he's on the roof because she's in a place that maybe
he can
only be seen from the roof.
Okay.
So when I think about what that may be. Perhaps like a courtyard of some kind.
Beautiful. So also, if you've ever been to Ir David, you know it's on an incline, right? It's a ridge or whatever. But like there's the upper part of the city and the lower part of the city, and it makes sense to assume that the king's palace would be the higher part, right? Like higher parts, both in terms of the metaphorical power of being on the higher part, and also in terms of defense, is where the more powerful people are going to be up above. So she might be bathing in her courtyard, which would be totally normal in that time period. That might be where you would bathe. And he can see her because he's on higher ground, and now he's on the roof of his higher ground palace. Or she might be on the roof, right? The fact that it doesn't say she's on the roof doesn't mean she's not on the roof. That reading is not explicit here. And that might affect how we're viewing the situation. So for now, we're just noticing. We're noticing that he's sort of on the higher ground, both within his own home on the roof, and most likely in terms of the topography of where his palace is vis-a-vis the rest of the city. And we're noticing this is happening late afternoon, early evening time. We've talked about the location. We talked about the timing. It is worth noticing that, first of all, if David HaMelech is getting up from his bed at late afternoon time, this is not exactly a sort of flattering image of a responsible king, right? You know, we know that he would wake up at the third hour of the day on a normal day and the ninth hour of a day after he had a big sudas melech, after a big sort of party. So this is not a sort of image of a responsible king, and that might affect how we're supposed to read what's going on here, right? The story itself seems to want us to view David HaMelech negatively here.
Beit HaMelech and not Beit Tov.
Uh-huh, yes.
Meaning like Beit HaMelech, like this is the house of the king, not him, because he's not really a king.
Beautiful.
Meaning like Beit HaMelech instead of Beit Tov.
Oh, I see. I got it. So you're saying is there's even an accusation in calling it Beit HaMelech rather than Beit Tov. Maybe. I'm not as sure about that, but I think you're right that like there's sort of an emphasis of this is someone taking advantage of his kingly privileges. But the other piece about the sort of late afternoon, early evening time is when you think about someone bathing at late afternoon, early evening time, why might that let me take one step back. We live in a culture where, for better or for worse, we assume, I'm not saying people do this, I'm not saying people should do this, but there's often an assumption that people shower daily, or at least every other day, let's say, right? That was not the case in biblical times. It is clearly the case that a bath, a non-ritual bath at least, was something that was very special, right? It was something that you do at an abnormal time. Why might you do that bath at late after, and by the way, it's not true for the time of the Gemara. Right? In the time of the Gemara, bathing is already a much more regular thing. But we know that in biblical times, it was still a sort of unusual thing. Why might you do that bath at late afternoon, early evening time? Why might that be the time when you're going to take your bath, as opposed to, you know, first thing in the morning, which is when, in my culture, many people do their showering. I hate showering in the morning, but I know other people do. Yeah, Jeremy.
Because you can still see, roughly, but you can assume that other people would see you if it's getting dark.
Okay, so, right, this is a moment when sort of there's still light out. We don't have electric lights yet, so I don't want to bathe in my courtyard when it's nightfall already, but it's already, things are quieting down, right? It's like, you know, in my neighborhood, in like a quasi-suburban part of New York, quasi-suburban or really suburban?
Quasi.
Quasi-suburban part of New York. You know, like at 5 o'clock, I can like go to the store and it's still open, whatever else, but like it's quieter. And that might also have an impact on our expectations of privacy, of the timing of it, what's going on there. Okay, we've done some noticing. Let's talk about some problems. What goes on here that is problematic? We have to abridge ourselves a little bit. We don't have that much time. Aviva, Ariel, and Nimi.
He finds out that she's married, and then he still sleeps with her.
Okay, great. For that, first of all, I'm glad you said that before I edited my question, because that's the most problematic thing here, right? David HaMelech clearly having sex with a married woman. There are all sorts of ways we and the rabbis can try to make this less problematic, but pshat of the story is clearly not a positive one for David HaMelech. Let me rephrase the question, though. Spilling around in terms of what happens in terms of David HaMelech seeing Bathsheba, right? That part is going to be the most relevant to what we're talking about this week. What are the problems when you focus on David HaMelech's gaze at Bathsheba? Ariel.
It seems like the timing and the choice to go out from this lookout seems almost slightly intentional to me. And, like, it's just bordering on sort of voyeuristic.
Beautiful. Take a look at source number two. This is the Malbim's commentary here. So first of all, it begins by emphasizing something we've already talked about, which is sort of negative portrayal of David HaMelech. V'gam acharkach, after this big meal, lo asak b'tzorchei tzibor. He wasn't, even though he like woke up late, he didn't say, I'm well rested, let me deal with the needs of my community. He said, rak halach l'tayel al gag beis HaMelech. He actually just went to go for a stroll on his roof. So this is clearly a negative portrayal of David HaMelech, says the Malbim. And through this, sort of not doing what he should have been doing, which is taking care of the people, but going for a stroll on his roof, he comes to transgression. He sees a woman bathing. And he didn't close his eyes from seeing this thing that he wasn't supposed to see. And moreover, he sees it from up on the roof. Right? If I'm on the roof, what am I looking at? I'm probably looking around. I'm seeing this, you know, if there are other roofs that are at my level, I might see that. If there are, you know, beautiful stars, I might be looking at the stars. But she's lower, right? She's lower in the city. And like I was saying before, probably she is in her courtyard, not on her own roof. And even if she were on the roof, it would probably be lower. He's actively looking, right? So there's a way in which exactly as Ariel's saying, and Malbim sort of picks up on this, well, I guess Ariel picks up on the Malbim, right? That there's an actual move here to say, like, He's actively trying to invade her privacy. It's not like on the subway when I noticed that I was reading this person's texts. No, I actually was like, I want to know what this person is texting. That's the mode that David HaMelech is in here, and that's a more specific problem. Beautiful. Nimi. Just louder, though.
I'll end up repeating the same sort of thing, but for me, it's like a cascade of, like, okay, you've seen someone, fine. But the observation that she's very beautiful, like, that takes intent to kind of, like, observe that and pay attention to the quality of the person you're looking at. And then also thinking in terms of, for me, when I'm thinking of, like, you're looking from a roof down, okay, you're looking down, fine, whatever. But to me, usually when you're looking down from a high place, things get smaller. Like, in order to see that she's beautiful, you really do have to be looking, because otherwise she has to be close to you for her to be big.
Beautiful. And that might even be what the moment means. I framed it the other way as, like, because she's lower, you have to be looking. But also, you have to really pay attention, right? She's down there, I'm really looking. Beautiful. I mean, not beautiful, but beautiful. Accurate. Accurate and careful reading. Sort of building on what Tocco was saying earlier about the sort of power dynamic as well, right? He's using his power not to take care of his people, but actually to invade their privacy and take what he wants. So, well, let's take a look at Radak, and then I'm going to try to bring a few summary points from the problems that we've raised. So, Nozer Radak says, Hu ra'a usa me'al hagag shaisa rochetzes bevesa. he sees her from on the roof because she was bathing in her house. Now, that actually, we actually have three possibilities here, right? We don't actually know that she was bathing in her house. That is the redox sort of reading of this. A totally plausible one. It actually is probably more plausible that she was bathing in her courtyard just based on archaeology and what we know about bathing in biblical times. And then there's a third possibility, which is the one that is common in art and Leonard Cohen songs, which is that she's bathing on the roof. And I think that's important to pull out because there are different expectations of privacy in all those places, right? On the roof, and this probably is the reason why there's that medieval tradition of painting Bathsheba on the roof. It's because that is a part of a sort of Christian theology of trying to take the criticism of David Melch away, right? Oh, it wasn't his fault. She was being provocative. Who bathes on their roof, right? It seems like that's why you have that tradition of Bathsheba being on the roof. It makes her the problem rather than David HaMelech. But as I said, as far as I've seen, Jewish commentators never read it that way, and all modern translations read it as she's not on the roof. If she's in her courtyard, well, that's a whole other story already, because it seems likely that in biblical times, you would have expected a modicum of privacy in your courtyard. Is it as private as being in your house, the way the Radak reads it? No. So there might be that sort of intermediate space, but sort of trending more towards where you'd expect privacy. And then there's in your house where you could really expect privacy, but, you know, if someone has a high window and binoculars, they still might peer into your window if you never put your blinds up anyway. Okay, so one, I want to sort of pull out some of the threads we've seen, things that have sort of raised, that might affect our thinking about what kinds of expectations of privacy I might have and what that might mean in terms of my obligations. We've talked about location, right? How much privacy can I expect? We've talked about time, you know, At late afternoon, early evening is a time when I might expect more privacy than first thing in the morning. And we've talked about the power dynamic, right? Both physically in terms of being higher and in terms of having the element of actual power that I am the king and can call this person in once I've seen them, so that the invasion of privacy becomes even more intense. Let's turn to protocols. We've named what's going on in the story. We've named some of the problems here. When you think about what would you do if you were in charge of the world and could legislate whatever you wanted, what might you want to put into place so that the David HaMelech and Bathsheba story doesn't happen again? I've got Noah with one. I've got Jordan with two. Sorry. And I've got Neve with three. Great.
I think it depends if you want to put the onus on the seer or on the seen. And if you want to put it on the seer, you can say either like, well, make it a rule that you can't look from your roof, or you have to have walls above your rooftops that you're not tempted. Or we could say, like, you should never be bathing in a position where someone could see you, especially if you know that your house is below the king and they can see you, or you can use some combination. But I think a lot of the presumptions of privacy become like, you could either say, if you care about your privacy, it's your responsibility to protect it at all costs, or you can say that like being a moral person means you have the obligation to make sure you're never infringing on anyone.
Okay, so I'm actually hearing three possibilities from Noah, right? One is make a law that says, take care of your privacy. Don't bathe somewhere where you could be seen. Two is make a law that says you're not allowed to look at people when they're bathing, right? In both of those cases, I can make a law, but I don't necessarily have a lot of control, right? Again, you know, how are we going to enforce it, whatever else? The third thing that Noah says is actually, not actually said in the other order, right? But the first thing that Noah said was build a wall so that you can't actually see from your roof, right? You have to build a wall. We're going to come back to that in a moment, all right? If I require a wall, well, then I'm not trusting your good nature to follow the law and not look. I'm saying, well, I can't look because there's that wall now blocking my view. We're now going to look at source number 4 in your packets. This is a bunch of Mishnayot from the first chapter of Bava Basra, the chapter we'll be learning tomorrow morning. And this is about building a wall and my obligation to build a wall. We're not going to do all of this together tonight, but we're going to do the parts that are most relevant to what you're seeing tomorrow and which also happen to be the most relevant to thinking about our questions of privacy. So take a look at where it says Mishnah Aleph, number 1 in the English. Hashutafin sheratzu la'asos mechitza. Don't look at the translation. I will translate it differently from how I translate it on the page. My translation's bad. Partners in a courtyard who wanted to make a mechitza. And that's actually a bad translation also, because when you hear mechitza, you picture, because of we live in 21st century North America, well, some of us live in North America or England or wherever else, right? You picture a mechitza. But let me translate that as you want to make a division, right? Because that word mechitza comes from lachatzos, to sort of split in half. So partners in a courtyard who wanted to make a division, bonin es hakozel be'emtza. They build the wall in the middle. And that goes on to some stuff we're going to skip because of, is just basically talking about the sort of different materials you might make that wall out of. Now, what let's pause here. Ignoring the translation I gave you, and just focusing on partners in a courtyard who want to make a division, what do you imagine that means? If I tell you partners in a courtyard want to make a division, give me one possibility for what that could mean. Leah Gittel.
Like they're not getting along. They're not friends, and they want to, like, separate their space, so they don't run into each other.
Okay, so they want to separate their space, so they don't run into each other. Spencer.
No, just a background assumption that the courtyard is shared by multiple properties.
Yes, that is a background assumption that's going to be made clear in later Mishnayos, but you're right, it's not actually made fully explicit here. Leora.
I was going to say, like, general property line divisions, which are just simple.
Okay, great. So it might be that I want to get in your way. It might be that I want to mark off my property. When I was growing up, we had neighbors who my parents did not get along with, and in their classic passive-aggressive way, rather than talking about it and dealing with it, my parents just planted bushes on the property line. And that wasn't because we wanted to maintain our privacy from them, it was because we wanted to make sure they knew, this is our property, that's your property. Great. Evan.
It could also be a division of time, like if the courtyard belongs to multiple properties, somehow there's a scheme to share that way.
Beautiful. I think that doesn't work here because of the second half of the sentence, which is if they want to do that, then they build a wall. But it's interesting to think about. You might think about, in the absence of that second half of the line, you might think about making a division by a timeshare rather than a physical division. Okay. Barack.
They might have household livestock and they're just concerned about, like, property moving between lines, eating other people's food.
Okay. In fact, you know, the case like with my neighbors growing up, it was actually their dog micturating on our lawn, that was the real problem, right? So, Adin.
I was going to say, it's interesting that sort of the way the Mishnah flows, is it like flows immediately from, like, let's say we're translating the pizza, just like a separation or like a division. It flows immediately from saying, let's say our neighbors want to make a division, they have to build a wall. Like, there's no consideration or idea, maybe you can have a division, but just like put a little line in the sand or like a short fence.
So speculate, why might that be? If we're saying we want to make a division, the next line is you have to make a wall. Why might I say to make a wall if you want to make a division?
I think the idea would be something like, if we're making a division, it's no longer like a shared courtyard. Rather, I have my half courtyard, you have your half courtyard. And in a shared courtyard, it might be okay with like sort of like a weak boundary, like there being no boundary in a shared courtyard. But if we're saying I have my private space here and you have your private space here, we're not okay with there being...
Now, what I want to note is that what everyone has said when reading this Mishnah is that even though this Mishnah talks about building a wall, and even though Noah and Nimi, I think, right? I forget. Noah and someone else raised, one thing I might do if I want to, Noah and Jordan, I think, right? One thing I might want to do if I want to prevent your gazing into my space is build a wall. This Mishnah doesn't tell us that. This Mishnah could be about just marking the property line. It might be about preventing your animals from pissing on my lawn. It might be all about, or it might be about, I don't want you to see my side of the courtyard, right? But we don't know that. This Mishnah is ambiguous in terms of what it's actually about, right? But there is this idea in the Mishnah that there are times when you have to build a wall. That much we see. Folks on board? Okay. Let's skip now to where it says in the Hebrew, Mishnah Bet, in the English, number 2. Vechen begina makom shenagu ligdor mechayven oso. Now, I don't know how to translate this line. There are different ways to punctuate here. I'm going to translate it a relatively traditional way, even though it might not be shot of this line, right? So go with me, and then if your teacher tomorrow asks you to read a different way, that's also okay. Likewise, in a garden, which is a place where people typically do put up fences, one is obligated to put up a fence. Aval bebika makom shenagu shelo ligdor ein mechayvin oso. But in a valley, which is a place where people don't typically put up walls, one is not obligated to put up a fence. What do you notice about this in terms of putting up a wall for whatever reason? What's sort of the relevant factor that's going to determine whether I'm obligated to put up a wall or not? Okay, great. Am I in a place where people typically put up walls? Like, do you have a place where everyone has a white picket fence around their lawn? Or are you in a place where people don't typically put up fences? And that actually is a relevant datum to determining, am I obligated to do that? Like I said, there's actually some ambiguity about how to read that line, but irrespective of how you read it, that point will come out. That communal custom is relevant. Now, we don't know that these walls are about Hezekiah, right? That notion doesn't get mentioned in these Mishnayos, but for the sake of thinking together, let's imagine that they are. Let's imagine that these walls we're putting up are to prevent a din from looking over at my side of the courtyard once we decide to split our courtyard in two. If that's the case, why might communal custom be relevant? Why might you say, if you're in a place where the custom is to put up a wall, you got to prevent a din from staring into my half of the lawn, but if you're a place where that's not the custom, you don't have to do that. Why might you think that way? Sarah.
Yeah, I would just say something similar, that like whether or not there's typically walls that like the social norm of what you're expecting to see or not see. That if everyone has walls and doesn't have walls, you might expect that they're more willing to have people see into the property because if they have walls.
Good, but that actually turns it around in the other direction as well, right? What Jord was saying is, it affects what I expect to see, and therefore when I happen to see something that I shouldn't, well, that might not be fully on me because it's a makom shenagu ligdor. It's a place where we expect to have those walls up. But there's also an expectation of, if I'm in a place where it's customary to put up walls, well, then I expect to have some privacy, right? And if we share a courtyard, well, then you had best put up a wall with me because I expect to be able to walk around my courtyard somewhat private, right? Whereas if I live in a place where that's not the custom, well, then maybe we would just sort of ignore that. Let's skip to Mishnah Dalet, number 4. Kozel chatzer shenafal. Mechayvin oso livnoso ad arba amos. If we've got a wall separating our courtyard into two and it falls down, well, then you're obligated to put it back up again ad arba amos, right? You have to put it up to 4 amos. An ama is roughly a half a yard, which means 4 amos is 2 yards roughly, which means 4 amos is basically 6 feet. This was actually really helpful during the sort of heart of the pandemic. Whenever they said six feet, they were saying dalet amos, right? You just had to keep your dalet amos separate from other people. So, and then skip a line towards this, me'arba amos ulamala ein mechayvinoso. But from 4 amos and above, we don't obligate someone. We don't, right, if Adin and I are sharing a courtyard, and if the wall falls down, I can force Adin to build a 6-foot tall wall, but not any higher. Why 6 feet? Why might 6 feet be relevant here? Louder, though.
Oh, if you have a concept of privacy, 6 feet is like for a reasonably tall person what their eye line would be. So protecting from, you know, reasonable... Beyond that.
Beautiful. I love everything about what Noah said, especially the if. If we're talking about privacy, 6 feet is a reasonable amount to expect privacy for. Now, why do I love that if? Because as I've pointed out a couple times already, we're talking about building walls, and that's great because Noah raised building a wall as a way to establish privacy, but our mission doesn't tell us that's the reason. We've come up with lots of other reasons you might build a wall, but 6 feet, that's interesting, right? Because if the goal is just to get a dean's dog not to piss on my lawn, I don't need 6 feet for that. So 6 feet might imply, I am not confident in general, so certainly not when reading this text, but it might imply that this is a privacy piece, right? To my mind, this might be the first thing we've seen that would imply privacy. Let's go back to our question of protocol. So we've got one protocol. If I want to have privacy, I might say, put up a wall, right? And notice here, well, we actually don't know who's putting, both parties are required to put up the wall, at least in the opening Mishnah. Okay, what else might you establish as a way of creating privacy so that a dean can't keep looking over onto my side of the courtyard? Besides a wall. All right, I'll call on myself. I might also put into effect distance, right? For a certain distance away, that can create some amount of privacy. Even if you can still sort of see, but it's harder to see. As someone was saying earlier, when you're sort of really small, it requires more active gaze to see that, and that might create another element of privacy. Take a look at sources 5 and 6. This is from the second chapter of Bava Basra. This is a sugya that we'll get to, I believe, on Tuesday, if I remember correctly. Mishaya koslo samuch lekosel chaveiro, someone who has a wall close to another person's wall. I should also say, as we're learning these passages this week, it is a good idea to have blank paper and a pencil or pen that you can like try to map out what's going with the architecture here. So, and it's not always going to be clear, but sounds like, you know, our houses abut, right? We're not necessarily talking about a courtyard anymore, but our houses are close to each other, or at least the walls of our courtyards are close to each other. We're not necessarily talking about a shared courtyard. Lo yismoch lo kosel ela im ken hirchik mimenu arba amos. I may not put up a wall unless it's at least 4 amos, our good friend 4 amos again, 6 feet away. V'hachalonos milamalan u'milamatan u'mikenegdan 4 amos. If I want to put windows in my wall, they have to be 4 amos from above, 4 amos from below, 4 amos from the same height. which seems like what it means is, we'll see in the next text, it clarifies, my windows have to be at least 6 feet higher than your windows, at least 6 feet lower than your windows, and at least 6 feet away from your windows. How do we know this? The Tosefta, which is very often a sort of companion text of the Mishnah, often explains what the Mishnah means, even though some of us, not all of us, think the Tosefta was earlier, but Jeremy's mad at me for saying that. Look at the end of Tosefta 1:5. Lamala min astadin kadesha lo yehe roe. It's got to be at least 6 feet higher so that you will not see. Milamata kadesha lo yatsitz. It's got to be at least 6 feet lower so you're not peeking. Mikenegdan kadesha lo yafilu. And it's got, if my windows are on the same level as yours, it's got to be 6 feet away so that I don't create darkness for you. Right? Meaning the wall has to be at least 6 feet away. And this goes back to what Nissim was saying about, you know, blocking my light. So we can see how this idea of blocking your light is overlapping with Hezekiah concerns, because it's going to affect where and how I can build, but it's actually a different concern, right? The first two of those were now at the height of my windows, and they have to be not within sort of eye distance of your windows. The first two of those are about looking, so that I can't look in your windows, right? I have to be a certain height above or below your window so that I can't see in. And that's another way I might create privacy, is not by building a wall, but by creating enough distance that it's hard to actually see it. All right, last thing I want to raise before we part ways for the night. We've talked about building a wall. We've talked about distance. And I want to talk about angles as well. That's probably not the right word, but you'll see what I mean when you see the source. Take a look at source number 7. I will tell you that Mishnayot Hey and Vav are here for sugyas that probably most shiurim will not get to. There's a section of additional sugyas at the end of the packet. Most of us are not going to get to those sugyas, so don't worry too much about Mishnayot Hey and Vav here. We're going to look at Mishnah Zion. Lo yiftach adam halanosav l'chatzar shutafin. A person may not open windows onto a shared courtyard. So if Ellie and I have, again, we got it would be easier if I could draw on a whiteboard, but I forgot to plan that. So if Ellie and I have houses that each open up onto a shared courtyard, I may not open up windows onto that courtyard. Why not? What do you speculate?
Space makes sense. It blurs the boundaries. What's your opinion?
Okay, say one more sentence. In what way does it blur the boundaries?
Because while it technically is a private space, there's a communal space in the middle, and there's not really that hard stop anymore, and it sounds like there's a lot of different other things.
Beautiful. Davida.
If the problem with the Zagria, then if someone's sitting even in their space in the courtyard, and they look up, they can see into the work.
Oh, great. Or maybe the other way around, right? A dean is sitting on his side of the courtyard that we divided half an hour ago, and now I have a window onto the courtyard, and I can see a dean sunbathing, right? Like, that might be inappropriate, right? There might be an invasion of privacy. So it seems like there's a privacy concern here with opening up a window onto a courtyard. A dean and then Evan.
Sarah, I should say, though, here, like, my assumption was that's like a, like, this is not the split courtyard. This is a courtyard which is still equally shared.
Correct. Yeah, it is... It is a court. Is it necessarily a courtyard that has not been divided? I think that's right. Yeah. Evan.
Well, the courtyard is probably in the direction of the adjacent dwelling. So if both people build windows looking in the courtyard, they're at full surrounding each other.
Beautiful. Evan is like, it's like I paid him to be the shill to get me to the next line of the Mishnah. Because look at the next line. Lo yiftach adam l'chatzar shutafin, pesach keneged pesach v'chalon keneged chalon. A person should not open under their shared courtyard a doorway parallel to a doorway and a window parallel to a window. So now Ellie and I are still living in two houses on the opposite sides of this shared courtyard, and Ellie, for some reason, already has a window open, even though we just said you can't open up a window. But for some reason, she was able to get a window in. The Rashbam commenting on this, he says, oh, where you had a chazakah, where you had a sort of a legal presumption, a right already to build a window, because we just said you're not allowed to build a window at all, right? But let's say she's got a window there, and I want to open up a window now, and I've got a legal right to do it, even though it's problematic. When I make my window, I got to make sure it's not parallel to Ellie's window. Because now, well, you tell me, what happens if I build a window that's exactly parallel to Ellie's window? Yeah, Liora?
Directly into
okay.
The room as opposed to, like,
yeah, and the same thing for a doorway, right? Ellie's got a doorway. When I'm building my doorway, I better make sure my doorway is not exactly opposite hers, because then if she and I are going out of our house at the same time, I can see the ugly wallpaper she put up on her living room, right? And she doesn't want me to see that. I'm sure you have beautiful wallpaper. Right? But so the parallel piece is another way of preventing that sort of invasion of privacy. See, at least one way of determining, we might offer other possibilities, but at least of invading from my house to your house. Yeah, Josephine.
I would think that one of the benefits of having a courtyard, I mean, I'm thinking about this today, but like the nice thing about it is that you can get beautiful light from your courtyard and have this kind of place. So this feels like taking away a really nice benefit
beautiful.
Of having a courtyard, and it feels like something that maybe you would want to have the chance to negotiate with the person who gives the courtyard rather than having an outright rule about not having.
Fantastic. So Josephine raises the trade-off, right? The more privacy I have, the less sunlight I'm going to get. And so that feels like a hard thing. And why would I have a rule rather than require negotiation around this? In terms of hard rule versus negotiation, keep that question in mind when we get to the sugya on Thursday. I mean, in particular, there's a text from the Yad Ramah we'll get Thursday. Don't look ahead. Don't cheat. That's Torah. You can cheat if you want. Right? But we're going to see a text from the Yad Ramah on Thursday that's going to, I think, get exactly that question you raised, Josephine, of negotiation versus a rule, and why might that be the case? But for tonight, what I want you to focus on is there's a trade-off, right? And there are always going to be trade-offs. The more privacy we're trying to protect, the more other things we're going to give up. And we constantly have to be thinking about, well, is it more important that Ellie and I can have windows and good sunlight in our homes, or is it more important that Ellie and I can feel secure and private in our own homes? Okay, so as we part, not that I'm giving you an assignment, but if you feel inspired to think about some things on your walk or subway ride home, or car ride home, whatever it may be, I want you to think about of the things we raised in the first go-around. We were talking about what are places in our lives where privacy issues come up. If you were to think about the texts we learned tonight and the issues that they raised, what of those issues might be relevant to which of those things that we raised? And what of the things that we raised are actually not clearly addressed, forgive me clearly, are not even implicitly addressed by the texts we've seen tonight. That's a good way to get yourself thinking about these questions so that tomorrow morning we are raring to go to jump right into the sugyas. Have a good night, everyone. Get good rest. It's going to be a long and intense week.